Coming up this week, diving the wreck of England's oldest surviving ship.
Returning to one of Time Team's very first digs.
And I'll be answering your questions.
It's all on this episode of the Time Team Podcast.
Welcome to another edition of the Time Team Podcast with Helen Geek and Martin Williams.
It's a jam-packed episode this week with our very good friend, Derek Pittman, on the programme with us a little bit later on, as well as someone who appeared in the very first series of Time Team. You'll be getting a bit of an update, actually, on a dig that we did in 1994, which has been throwing up archaeology ever since.
First, though, let me take you to one of Europe's most important Neolithic sites. Last year, we filmed the final season of excavation at the Ness of Brodgar, a vast complex of monumental buildings set between the iconic stones of Stennes and the Ring of Brodgar in Orkney. The trenches have now been backfilled, but the investigation didn't stop there.
In partnership with the Ness team, Time Team carried out a final phase of cutting-edge geophysical survey across the entire site. And it's got people quite excited. So let's head to Orkney now to join our very own John Gator, Time Team geophysicist, and Nick Card, an archaeologist at the Ness of Brodgar. Hello to you two.
Hello there.
Hi there.
Hello, nice to see you all the way from Orkney. And before we get into what the geophysics has revealed, set the scene for us here. What is the Ness of Brodgar and why is it so important?
Well, the Ness of Brodgar was only discovered a little over 20 years ago when John undertook the initial phase of the World Heritage Site geophysics program. And what it was revealed was this amazing complex of anomalies, but as usual, sometimes difficult to say exactly what they are without putting spade to turf. So over the last 20 years, we've discovered that this huge mound, it's well over 250 metres long, 100 metres wide, basically covers the tip of the Brodgar Peninsula, is this huge complex of Neolithic buildings, but not just one phase of buildings, it's a whole sequence of them, one built on top of the other. It spans the whole of the Neolithic period of Northern Britain from about 3,500 BC to about 2,300 BC, so well over a millennium of use at the Ness. But it's not just the buildings, the architecture, it's everything that goes with it. An amazing, well, the largest assemblage of Neolithic art in the UK, probably more than the rest of the UK put together. The largest assemblage of grooveware pottery, plus everything else as a Neolithic archaeologist you could ever wish to find.
Yeah, it's sort of the perfect job, isn't it, for the likes of you, Nick? And also then for you, John, coming in with your geophysics, explain how you got involved in the project and what you've been doing.
I've been working up in Orkney for longer than I care to remember. I actually did my first survey, would you believe, 50 years ago, 1975.
Wow.
I was probably about three then, I think. And so I've had a long time working up here, coming up here on holiday. I actually came up on holiday some 25 years ago and did a survey at the Stones of Stennes because this was a classic geophysics site. I wanted to survey it with modern techniques. And so I did that when I was on holiday. And that, in essence, was the start of a series of surveys in Orkney on the World Heritage Sites because the results are quite special. I couldn't actually quite believe the strength and the patterns that we were seeing on the computer. I didn't believe it could be archaeology until we stood back and looked at the wider picture. And then we started to realise that we were actually probably seeing buildings and we weren't mapping igneous dikes.
I think that the word unique is sometimes bandied around all too frequently, but I think in the case of the Ness, the architecture, these aren't just buildings, they're pure architecture, elements, you know, intertwined with engineering, but also aesthetics. And they are just magnificent. What they must have looked like in the heyday when they were first built must have been quite jaw-dropping.
Yes, astonishing.
Let's talk about some of the more recent work that you've been doing then and the geophysics, John, that you've been working on, because there has been some real excitement in the last little while, hasn't there?
Yes, I think it's fair to say that's true. I mean, all the initial work we did was using magnetometry. What we've done for the first time, having come back to film the 20 years of the excavations for Time Team, it was felt, well, this is an opportune moment to actually bring in the high-tech GPR. It's never been used up here before, never been used in Scotland. We spent just 3 days on site, and during those 3 days, we were able to map the whole of the peninsula. And, yeah, I think Nick and Anne and Mark were quite impressed by the results.
You could say that. It's just jaw-dropping. I think it's clarified so many aspects of the site, but it has emphasized that what we see is just the tip of this huge archaeological iceberg, and the 40 or so Neolithic structures that we've so far encountered are accompanied by probably dozens more.
Wow. So what happens now?
Well, what we haven't told you is the GPR mapped a complex of buildings that we thought were going to be there. As we extended the survey beyond the monumental wall that defines the limits of the main complex, we actually started to reveal something that was quite unexpected.
Totally.
Something totally different to the rest of the buildings on the Ness. We just were not expecting this at all.
And so what are you going to do about it? I mean, you can't just leave it there, can you?
Well, I think the plans now, I think we're all agreed that we have to investigate this, because this is just so totally different. We just have to know, because I think it will add a new chapter to the history of the Ness.
Time Team have looked at this, and it's an opportunity not to be missed. So we're going to work in collaboration with Nick and the team, and next July, we're going to have a 4-week excavation.
Oh my goodness, how brilliant. I really hope I get allowed to come up to see what's going on.
There's no Anglo-Saxons here.
So you think.
There are two distilleries, several gin palaces. You'd be in your element.
Excellent, excellent. I think we should go, don't you, Martin?
I think we absolutely have to. This is something that we cannot miss. Yeah. It sounds so exciting. I'm excited already. Can't wait.
Yes, and in the intervening time, of course, you can follow the whole story of the excavations at the Ness in a brand new Time Team special, which is coming out soon. And I can't wait to, if I'm allowed, to go up to Orkney for the new excavation next summer.
A month to go then until Christmas, Helen. There's still no Christmas tree up in my flat, I have to say. But when I do get it, I always get the tiniest, tiniest little one. It barely goes above my knee. It's so tiny, quite pathetic.
However tiny it is, I think it's wrong to do it in November. I think you've got to wait another week. Come on. I have made some mincemeat, although I have to admit I made it last year. It's a leftover from last year, but I'm all ready to make mince pies as soon as the starting gun is fired on the 1st of December. I absolutely love mince pies, and I think I'm a bit of a dab hand at making them. I'm very much looking forward to that.
Well, it is very much sort of non-stop Christmas music in supermarkets and department stores and anywhere. Oh. So people are doing their shopping, they are doing their preparations, and you were probably in the throes of your Christmas preparation panic as well. And maybe you need some good gift ideas for the Time Team fan or history and archaeology buff in your life. Allow us to be of service.
Yes, of course, however much of a humbug you are, it's always good to get your Christmas present shopping in early. And the ultimate fan present is the Time Team membership, which is available to purchase as a gift subscription directly on our Patreon membership page. But if you're still looking for some alternative gift ideas, or if you are wondering about something special for a fussy fan, or if you still need a couple of stocking fillers, we have got you covered. Check out the Time Team official shop.
There is so much there. I really like the etched enamel camping mug. Mm. And it has either a blue or a yellow rim. They just sort of make you feel like you're part of the team. You're having a quick little brew on site, having just got out of your tent in the middle of a beautiful beautiful historic landscape.
You're right, they are lovely things. But I'm really hoping that somebody might buy me, there's a really gorgeous stripy bag, which is just the colours of one of Mick's jumpers. And it's really practical. It's made from recycled materials, which of course Mick would very much have approved of. And if only I found that in my stocking, it would remind me of him every day. And all of those gift ideas and many more are available from the shop at timeteamdigital.com.
Yeah, head there now if you fancy picking up something to get your loved one for Christmas. Now, the fifth episode of Time Team ever broadcast was about some remarkable work on a Scottish island called Islay, just off the west coast. Archaeologists believe they discovered evidence of a forgotten medieval kingdom. They'd been working on it for 5 years already before Time Team stepped in 1994.
But the work didn't end after the cameras stopped rolling and Tony, Mick and the rest of the team left. Over 30 years later, we're still learning more about Finlaggan.
One of the archaeologists who's been working on the site the whole time is Dr. David Caldwell, who actually featured in that Time Team programme. David, I've seen some, I was watching it back earlier and you, I mean, everyone's aged, haven't they?
Yes, I was watching it as well. And it was quite a revelation just seeing how black-haired and bushy I was at that time. But I hope I've matured a bit with age as well, so...
Yes, like a fine wine, I imagine. What were your memories, David, of that visit, of Time Team coming along to the site that you'd already been working on for 5 years?
I was impressed, first of all, with how professional people were. I worked for the National Museums and was used to being involved with big projects. But the Time Team was a body that could come in and do a project very quickly and get to the nub of what was required. But when the team came, they were all really nice, thoroughly professional people, and we got a great deal out of the whole experience.
Well, we'll get to that in a moment, and also the work that's been happening since then. But first, David, just set the scene. What is Finlaggan? Where is Finlaggan? Paint a picture for me.
Finlaggan is on the island of Islay off the west coast of Scotland. Until 1266, those islands were not part of Scotland. They belonged to a separate kingdom, the Kingdom of the Isles. And even people in Scotland have tended to forget this. We had the impression that Finlaggan had been a very important centre. And what we were trying to demonstrate was that Finlaggan was the centre of this separate kingdom, a kingdom which in many ways went on right into the medieval and post-medieval period. And we were interested to demonstrate what the culture of this separate kingdom was, because in many ways, what we Scots see as being quintessentially Scottish, whiskey, bagpipes, tartan, Celtic things, if you like, all sorts of Gaelic, all those sort of things, in many ways, their main roots go back to the patronage of kings and lords of the Isles in the medieval period.
So could it be argued then that, what, like bagpipes are not Scottish in inverted commas?
Well, you're getting into very complicated territory here.
You're going to have a fight on your hands, I think, if you go around saying that.
So Finlaggan itself is on this island, and to begin with, it's not actually part of Scotland. And the area itself, of course, is very rugged. The landscape is very rugged, very beautiful. So just to complete the story, how did it then become a part of Scotland?
Until 1266, these islands were a separate kingdom, okay? But the kings of the Isles owed allegiance to the kings of Norway. A lot of the population of the Isles at that time were of Scandinavian origin. The whole area had been settled by Vikings and their descendants. In 1266, the king of Norway admitted that he couldn't control these islands and basically sold them to the kings of Scots. So in the post-1266 period, there was a process of integration of these people and these islands into the rest of Scotland. But it was not a very thorough process. And I maintain that the lack of effort by the kings of Scots, if you like, was one of the main reasons that they developed in Scotland this divide between the people of the lowlands and the people of the highlands, that there wasn't really true integration, arguably, until recent times.
Let's talk about the archaeology. How rich is it there?
The archaeology at Finlaggan is rich by Scottish standards. But, you know, you go to the site and what you see is two relatively small islands in a loch. And we discovered ruins of buildings. We are claiming that this was the centre of a lordship, of a kingdom. And perhaps as an outsider, you might look at it and think, well, there's not really that much there. There's not a great town. There's not an enormous church. There's not streets. There's not sort of fortifications all over the place. And I think one of the points that I think emerges from the work we did at Finlaggan is that this in many ways is an alternative model for society, for civilization in the medieval period. They were powerful because of the resources they were able to take into battle.
And what sort of evidence have you found to support some of these ideas of what life might have been like on Finlaggan? What sort of finds have there been?
We found evidence at Finlaggan in the later medieval period, say the 14th, 15th century, for a layout of buildings, what we in Scotland would call a palace. What we detect and what we discovered is a ritual, if you like, arrangement. The main building was a great hall where there was feasting. There were large kitchens. There was a chapel where business could be done. There was a commemorative cross. The buildings, storage buildings, residences, workshops were all connected by cobbled paths. And what we detect is that the layout facilitated annual meetings where business in the whole lordship, the whole area of the West Highlands and Islands was done, where the great men could process from one building to the other on the main island and then across a causeway where there was a building known as the council building. It was like a parliament. It was equivalent of a parliament. What we also found was underlying, if you like, this palace complex was a castle. While I was excavating at Finlaggan, I often said to people politely, when they talked about the work we're doing at Finlaggan Castle, no, we don't have a castle here. It's not a castle. That's misleading. There's no castle here. And then we started excavating a castle. And what we found was that the smaller island, Éilí na Cóirlí, which is Gaelic for the council island, what we found was that the substantial part of that island was actually the foundations of a great tower. A tower, what we used to call Norman keeps, which is very unusual there in North Britain. What's intriguing about it is we don't know what it was called. We don't have a name for it. And we don't 100% know who built it. My best guess is it was built by Ranald, the son of Somerled, who is referred to in contemporary documents as King Ranald. So what I think we're looking at is a major royal centre that we didn't know existed and for which we don't have a name. And that, I think, in archaeological terms, is quite exciting.
So exciting. Well, that brings me on very nicely to my final question, which was going to be, what is there still to do? Because you paint an amazing picture of the discovery so far, so much that you know about society there, what life was like, the shape of where the buildings were laid out, how people would have operated in those buildings. And then, of course, the discovery of the castle, which is so exciting. Where do you go from there then?
I'm tempted to say that where we go from here is all over the place. Not me personally, okay? Other people. I've had my shot. I put a lot of work into this. And what I've tried to do in the book that's just been published by the Society of Antiquaries of Scotland is give a reasonable account of what we did and why we made the decisions we did. And it's backed up by an enormous archive of the excavation material, which has been deposited with Historic Environment Scotland. So what I hope I've done is provided a platform for another generation of scholars and experts to come along and say, well, Caldwell didn't do that. Maybe we could do it now, or maybe we don't agree with what he did. I hope I've done a fair enough job for that to happen. And there's so much more we could learn. We will never find another enormous batch of medieval documents that relate to the lordship of the Isles, or the kingdom of the Isles. But archaeology and the way it's developing, I'm sure you can tell us an awful lot more in the future. So anybody out there who thinks they can do it, please, it's not mine. It's for you to do more.
Brilliant. Well, David, the very best of luck with it. And of course, to also all the people who'll follow in your footsteps there. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
I've been thinking quite a lot about the bravery of the divers who did underwater archaeology on the wreck of the Mary Rose. You know, something that we learnt about, didn't we, in that previous episode of the podcast.
Yes, and Time Team's been doing its own work beneath the waves. Our expedition crew have returned to investigate the wreck of England's oldest surviving ship, a medieval vessel off the south coast, and it'll be part of a new film coming to our YouTube channel very soon.
Derek Pittman, one of our brave expeditioners, is here with the details. Derek, hello. And Helen said that you've returned to this wreck. So you've been here before, haven't you?
Yeah, so Time Team's got a bit of a history with this one. We've been really fortunate in that we've followed the wreck on multiple occasions. And regular viewers might remember we put out a short piece a few years ago on our first trip out on the boat. It was a really exciting trip, and viewers will remember it as one where I became quite unwell with seasickness. But we've since gone back, and I think it maybe popped up in the news a little bit a while back. But what we really wanted to do was tell the whole story of the wreck from beginning to end. So we've gone back to Poole, done a little bit more filming, and the brilliant Time Team editing crew and producers have put together a whole documentary on the Mortar Wreck, and I'm really excited that it's coming out very soon.
So why is it called the Mortar Wreck? I mean, tell me a bit about it. What's it? What was it?
So it's a early medieval shipwreck just off the coast of Studland Beach in Dorset. And the primary cargo was Purbeck stone. So it was shipping cargo from the quarries of Purbeck to around the south coast, I suspect. But it went down very early on in its voyage. And the first things that were turning up in that cargo were incredible carved stone mortaria. So mortars for presumably cooking, kitchen work. Some of them enormous, really incredible pieces.
Like a pestle and mortar, that kind of mortar.
Yeah, but interestingly, no pestles. I've not seen a single one, but many, many mortars, yeah. and other carved Purbeck stone things, some of which I'll probably let the episode tell you about.
Wow, yeah.
So why did you want to go and investigate this particular site? What interests you about it particularly?
Well, it's a cracker for me, to be honest, because my colleagues here at Bournemouth have been investigating wrecks off the south coast for many years. And this was one that my colleague Tom Cousins was leading on. And it fits really neatly into my own research. As you know, and as Time Team followers will know, we did some work at Witch Farm near Corfe Castle some time ago, looking at Iron Age and Romano-British industries. And the industry of Purbeck is something that is very close to my heart from prehistory right the way through the medieval period. So I've been investigating the stone quarries and the links between our sites in my study area and the wider Purbeck landscape. So for me, this wreck fits very neatly into that. So other than the opportunity to jump on a boat and watch some diving, it was a great opportunity to learn a little bit more about something that a little gap in the knowledge, the moving of stuff around. We don't often see things moving around. We see where it starts and we see where it ends, but this is a little snapshot halfway through a journey, which is quite lovely.
Yes, you're right. I'm so fascinated about transport, about how you get things from somewhere to somewhere, not just ships, but also over land, where of course it's much harder. And if this wreck is medieval, how much of it is left?
Preservation-wise, it's pretty impressive. So there's an awful lot of the keel of the ship is still down there. An awful lot of woodwork is preserved. So far, the things that the divers have brought up have been primarily the cargo, the stonework, as well as a lovely bronze, I forget the name of it, but a cooking vessel, like for a brazier that presumably the crew would have used. The preservation on the stonework, though, it's almost new. It feels like it's come straight out of the quarry. It's quite remarkable.
Right. So you're going back then. I mean, other than hoping you don't get seasick again, what are you hoping to achieve in this return visit?
The return visit's a really important one because the divers are bringing up some very large bits of cargo. They're having to get a whole big barge out to lift some of this cargo, which is destined for a brand new maritime exhibit in Poole Museum. And that's, I think, where we kind of want to finish the story, with having watched the divers investigate this material, bring some of it up, right the way through to it being on public display.
Well, that sounds really fantastic, that we'll be able to go and have a look at some of the almost brand new items from the Purbeck Quarry that you could have bought back a few centuries ago.
Yeah, and I don't know if I'm allowed to say, but I had a sneak preview of the exhibition the other day, and it is lovely.
Brilliant, because it is such a beautiful stone, Purbeck stone, isn't it? It's just gorgeous.
Now, Derek, whilst we've got you here, I also need to talk to you about a couple of other things. There's two items on my agenda. Item number one is another exciting project that you've been working on, which has been happening in Greece.
Yes, this one is very close to my heart. I've been working in Greece now since 2016, so we're getting up to our 10th anniversary of fieldwork out there. And we were fortunate enough a few years back to put together a Time Team episode on some of our survey out there. And it was a lovely piece because we got to tell a bit of the story of our site. But I think many of the commenters on YouTube, and I probably agree with this, would have liked to have seen a little bit more digging. So in the intervening years, we've been back, we've done some digging, we've done some excavation. And a little while ago now, probably a couple of years ago, we recorded one of our field seasons. And I'm pleased to say it'll be coming to screens near you very soon via Time Team.
Oh, looking forward to that. That's going to be great. And I'm very, very jealous of you getting to go and do some exciting work in Greece. That is absolutely wonderful.
Yes, I think we all are.
My final item on the agenda then, Derek, it's getting quite close to Christmas time, and I seem to remember last year you and Helen went head to head in the Time Team podcast Christmas quiz. Now, there was a bit of upset because Helen absolutely wiped the floor with you and I've been hearing nothing but it since. So look, what about a rematch?
I'm bang up for a rematch, but what I will say is I wouldn't consider that an upset. I think everyone knows Helen's much smarter than me.
This is what I'm proposing. I'm proposing the showdown. I'm proposing the rematch, the final battle to end all battles. You dress it up however you want, but it's you and Helen going back head to head for a rematch in the Christmas quiz. You up for it?
Bring it on.
He's up for it, Helen. Are you up for it?
I'm certainly up for it. Yes, absolutely. Got to consolidate my lead.
fighting talk already. All right then, Derek. Well, how about this? We'll speak to you in about a month. We'll do this on the 23rd of December. We'll speak to you in about a month.
Beautiful. See you then.
Lovely to see you, Derek. Bye.
Okay, time for some questions now. Thank you so much if you are one of the Patreon members who's got involved and submitted one of these. It's one of the many perks that you get of being a Time Team member, the opportunity to ask Helen a question on the podcast. Let's head straight over to Alana, who says, my son was asking me about how a pagan Irish festival, this is Samhain or Halloween, became a holy day, All Saints Day, which led to a discussion on the appropriation of pagan festivals by the church for their religious festivals. People having some very highbrow and important conversations in their households, which is a lot more than I ever find myself doing. Anyway, says Alana, it got me thinking, how do we know about pagan festivals? Is it just written sources like the Romans? How do we know about pagan festivals in parts of the world that the Romans didn't conquer? For example, Ireland. Is there archaeological evidence of festivals like midwinter festivals, which went on to become Christmas?
Well, really, I think I'd have to say that all our evidence of festivals really is in written historical accounts. So we know about Roman festivals from Roman writings. We know about Anglo-Saxon festivals from the little that Bede tells us. We know about Viking Age ones from things like the sagas and people like Adam of Bremen, and Irish festivals from early Irish texts. But the problem with those is that they're all written down rather later than the festivals that they describe. So if you think about what archaeological evidence might be like for festivals, well, sometimes some of those orientated monuments, places like Newgrange in Ireland, they've been suggested as evidence for a celebration of a solstice or whatever celestial event that they're orientated on. But all that really tells us is that people are interested in the solstices as a special moment, not that they had something like a festival around it. And the activities at a festival, well, they're really difficult to recover archaeologically because they don't leave much trace. How much does Bonfire Night or Halloween affect the ground? How much does it ever work its way into the archaeological record?
Yeah, you're not going to find a pumpkin, are you?
No.
Sort of several thousand years later or anything like that?
No, and even if you found that people were out having a good time, and we do have quite a lot of sites that, well, we have these sites called productive sites in the Middle Anglo-Saxon period where metal detectorists find that they produce lots of objects. And they've been normally interpreted as markets, not as festivals, even though festivals are a great moment for losing things. You know, your drinking is often in the dark. You're bound to be pulling things out of your pockets and finding that other things come as well. But even Christmas, you know, these moments are not really distinguishable from any just normal party. I have developed a bit of an interest in these regular festivals. And I've noticed that they occur at absolutely regular points in the year. I mean, I'm not the first to notice this. But you go through the year doing things like Pancake Day, and it never really occurs to you that these things are on the solstice and on the equinox, and then they're halfway between the solstice and the equinox as well, and they're absolutely regular as clockwork. So it's a kind of deep human need to have a party every now and then, even though in Britain we appear to have lost the summer parties. I suppose we've probably got enough summer parties. We don't need to add in the Lammas ones and the midsummer festivals and so on. But we do really have a deep need for Halloween and Bonfire Night, don't we? And a massive need for Christmas. And then Pancake Day fills in the gap between that and Easter. So there's something that I think is so deeply rooted in human beings that they don't need to be culturally specific, but finding out the details through archaeology, incredibly difficult.
We all just need a knees up, turns out.
Yeah, we do.
No matter when you were born in all of human history, we like a bit of a party. Great question. All right, David has the final one of the podcast today. And David says, "Hi, Helen. Given your enthusiasm and expertise in all things Anglo-Saxon, have you had the chance to visit the continent to excavate and explore their origins and settlements and graveyards in Germany and other parts of Central Europe? Is there anywhere over there that you especially would like to visit and explore?" This is good. This is sort of what's your holiday destination as an archaeologist, really, for Europe.
Yes, I have to say I'm very, very bad at holidays. I find them very, very difficult to organise and to take and so on. So the times that I've been over to what you might call Germanic Northern Europe, it's normally been for things like conferences or to go and look at specific museum exhibitions or to visit colleagues over there. I've never actually worked there, and as I say, I'm terrible at holidays. But I've never been, would you believe, to Scandinavia. It's something I've got to put right. And the place that I'd really like to visit is Gotland. The artefacts from Gotland are just very different from those anywhere else, and I don't know why. I mean, what is so special about Gotland? And I do love islands, and they're such romantic and lovely places, and I would really welcome the chance to add another island to my list of island experiences. So the place that I'd really love to go, David, if you're offering, I'd like to go to Gotland.
I see. I don't think he is, as it goes, but...
oh, well.
Never mind. Nice try. Okay, thank you so much for all those questions. If you've got a question and you want to put it to Helen, this is what it's all about. And as a Time Team member, you get the opportunity to get involved in the conversation and get your question on a future edition of the podcast. patreon.com/timeteamofficial is where you need to go. And then if you just click on the chats section there, once you're in, you'll notice that there's a little ongoing chat and you can just pop your question in there. And I do see it and I see them all and I respond to them all eventually. And we pick some to put on the podcast every time. By the way, if you're not currently a Time Team member, but you've always fancied having a go, right now we're offering you a free 7-day trial. So this is perfect if you have just thought, maybe I want to do it. Maybe I want to know what I get. If I want to support Time Team, it's the perfect opportunity to try us out. Go and do it now.
And that's about it for this edition of the Time Team podcast. Next week, we've got a very special episode about another mysterious shipwreck.
This is an interview that we recorded. It was supposed to be a little small segment as part of a longer podcast, but it was just so fascinating, this conversation. We've decided to make it into an entire episode. It's about the Sandaig wreck, the carcass, if you like, of a ship discovered on a beach in Orkney, saved by the community, and it's taken months and months of work, but archaeologists managed to discover the ship's identity and the incredible story of that ship as well. You'll hear it all next week.
So we'll catch up with you for that on the next edition of the Time Team podcast.
Thank you. Bye-bye.